Platform building. With Clint and Danny leading in the wizard. The
Because he looks like a lizard.
wizard. Who?
Steve, he's so ugly.
This week, we've been both Reddy and I have been looking forward to this chat for a fair while because it seems a lot of guys who do endurance sports seem to have complications, issues, or just little hiccups along the way with their heart. So today we're joined by two guests. First up is Dr. John Waite. If my maths is correct, he's got about 38 years experience in cardiology, which is amazing. But one of the major reasons that I reached out to John was he's also been competitive at Ironmans, marathons, and 70.3s for an extended period. So he kind of understands both sides of the both the heart and also the endurance side. So thanks for coming on, John. And also, we're lucky enough to be joined by Cam Brown, 12-time Ironman New Zealand champion, 30 years in the sport, professional since 1990, and also now has some experience in the heart health world. So thanks for joining, guys. And obviously, Tim Reed. Thanks for coming on, mate. And unfortunately, you also have some experience in the heart issues. So we'll be diving into that a bit today. Thanks for coming on, Reid.
No, thanks. Thanks for organizing
I guess we
the meeting. Cam, oh, sorry, before we kick off, how's the recovery been, Cam? Are you back to full training or what's been happening?
No, not full training. Sort of had 4 weeks, 5 weeks totally off, and then just slowly started just on the indoor trainer on the bike, just sort of 30 minutes to start with, just super low wattage, sort of 100, 120 wattage, and just slowly build it up, and then brought in a little bit of swimming, and then slowly brought in my running. The running was the last thing I came back with, and then sort of just been over in Australia now and just sort of starting to pick up things. I was running sort of an hour over there, just and did a few gravel rides, but just everything, just easy wattage, easy low heart rate, and I'll be doing that for sort of I think another month. Been told that have that 12-week really recovery to get back to full normal sort of health heart.
So I
Interesting.
guess we'll kick it off. John, why? I mean, it seems everyone we speak to knows someone in the endurance world who has had issues or complications with their heart. Is there a specific reason that endurance athletes and more so like long-term endurance athletes are more susceptible to having issues compared to, say, the general public?
I think it's important to remember that we're just ordinary people at the best of times. Some of us are more ordinary than others. And so we are still susceptible to the same risk factors that can cause heart disease. And so if we think of things like heart attacks and angina and those sorts of common or garden type heart problems we deal with on a day-to-day basis, being, men with, as we get older, the risk of heart disease goes up. So it's important that we're a lot of triathletes think they're indestructible because they, do a lot of training and look after themselves well. But an exercise is, as a rule, extremely good for the heart. We encourage all our patients to exercise. You still can be predisposed to other heart problems. And in particular, as we get older, obviously people can get coronary artery disease and, heart attacks do occur in races, particularly in the older age group, particularly in my cohort of friends. It can occur. But rhythm disturbances are a separate issue, and this is something that's come to light in the last couple of years. We've all run atrial fibrillation clinics for years and years and years, and most of our patients are very elderly and frail. 10% of 80-year-olds are in atrial fibrillation. A lot of the time, they don't even know they're in atrial fibrillation. It's just part of the aging process. And then we began to notice in our waiting rooms, people like your father, Clint, people who shouldn't have been there. And we were confused as to why this was happening. So, a lot of work was done. A lot of work was actually done by a fellow called Andre LaGersh in Melbourne, and he does a lot of exercise cardiology. And he noticed that with long-term high-level exercise training, there are structural changes within the heart that occur that predispose us to arrhythmias, and in particular to atrial fibrillation. Now, atrial fibrillation is a very common rhythm disturbance, and is where the top two chambers of the heart. So the heart is basically four chambers. The two bottom chambers are the main pumping chambers, and the top two chambers are like the reservoirs where the blood goes into before it goes into the main pumping chambers. And when you're performing high-level intense exercise training, as we tend to do when we're Ironman triathletes, it means that the heart is pumping a huge volume of blood, you know, 40 litres a minute, massive amounts of blood. And as a consequence, the heart tends to stretch up, and in particular the atria. Those are the top two chambers of the heart. And that's where the electrical wiring system sits. So that's where your electrical wiring system is organized out of. And if you chronically stretch up, particularly the left atrium, you end up with a rhythm called atrial fibrillation. And if you chronically stretch up the right atrium, you end up with a rhythm called atrial flutter. So where the chaotic electrical activity occurs. And this is what you had, Cam. And we see it quite often. And your father's had it as well, Clint. And I think, Tim, you're... I actually suffer with supraventricular tachycardia as well, but mine's very quiet and I haven't needed anything doing. But I don't think your rhythm disturbance is really associated with long-term, you know, excessive exercise. Yours is more a quirk of nature. It's a short.
Yeah, interesting. Because I noticed it very early on with racing, actually, like within my first couple of years of racing. And I wasn't training that much, but I've also had AF as well. So, but thankfully only I've been zapped out of AF once and haven't had, apart from post ablation where I felt like I went back into AF, but didn't actually record it. But that was because I was told I could resume normal training a week after ablation. And I don't think they realized what normal training was to me. So I probably put, you know, this, I didn't realize that there's quite a bit of inflammation and, you know, obviously they're poking around in there trying to get a response to push you into, I guess, find out where the spot is they need to sort out. But, yeah, that's interesting. So you're saying it's more hereditary SVT compared to AF, subventricular tachycardia?
Well, you were probably born with an electrical short circuit in your heart. And to be honest with you, pretty well everyone has that same short circuit. It just doesn't get opened up. So I know that when I was a kid, I used to get a lot of SVT. And in those days, there wasn't really any specific treatment available. Now with the new procedures we can do on the heart, we can get rid of it very easily. Now mine's all settled down, but if it should come back, then I've already got my name down on the list to get it sorted. It's a very straightforward procedure as a rule. I mean, everyone's a bit different, but now if you've had atrial fibrillation as well, then you should be aware that you are going to be a little predisposed to further episodes of atrial fibrillation potentially in the future. That's an inevitable part of our training programs.
Interesting. So I guess on the with atrial fibrillation, and if athletes are chronically enlarging their atrium, if I've got that correct, is there a way a lifelong athlete could avoid that? Or, you know, is there something we as coaches too we could be implementing to ensure long-term heart health without obviously stopping people from training for too long a period? What are the options as coaches or as a health practitioner advising around this for athletes?
Well, there's an electrophysiologist in Adelaide called Prash Sanders, who's one of the most respected men in this field on the planet. And Prash says 6 hours a week. After 6 hours a week, your risk of atrial fibrillation increases. So that's why the current guidelines for our patients are that really we recommend about an hour's exercise, moderate exercise a day, you know, plus or minus a day off. So 6 hours a week. Beyond 6 hours, unfortunately, does predispose you to atrial fibrillation occurring. Now, that doesn't mean every single endurance triathlete is going to end up with atrial fibrillation, but you do have an increased risk of that occurring as you get older.
Is that specific to a certain intensity, or like what, you know, I mean, there's zone one training, like, which is considered, you know, sort of around that 50 to 55% of max heart rate, or even, yeah, when they looked at that 6 hour a week training, what was the intensity that they were looking at?
Much less than what you guys are doing, for sure. And so they're talking, you know, like a brisk walk or a gentle swim, not you know, sit on the tri bike for 5 hours. You know, they're talking about fairly gentle stuff. And obviously, it's a case of volume and quality. You know, if you're doing very intense stuff for long periods of time, your atria are inevitably going to get stretched out more than if you're doing low level for a shorter period of time. It's just a sheer, it's a numbers game. It's a volume game.
And Cam, you notice symptoms, from a younger age, or did you feel like it just came on was there a period of time where you feel like, looking back, you feel like you might have had it longer than you thought?
Yeah, definitely. So the first sort of, I started getting panic attacks in my swims, and I'd had, you know, sort of, God, that was probably, I think I did a post on it in Taupo 70.3 8 years ago, and it came up just recently, and that was the first time I've ever had a panic attack in a swim. You know, my heart rate skyrocketed, and I just had to slow down. I was almost came to a complete stop, and just had to relax. And then it didn't happen for a while, and then probably the last 2 years sort of seemed to happen every time I raced. I'd have a panic attack, and I just thought, there's something wrong with my head now. I've never had these things at all throughout my career, and then all of a sudden I'm starting to have these panic attacks every race I do. You know, I was only sort of racing, you know, 7-8 times a year, it was a bit of a worry, and I just thought it was more mental than physical. And then finally over in Noosa last year, I did the Legends Tri Race, just a 3K bike ride, and my sort of heart rate skyrocketed again, and I thought, I'm going to go and see someone after this. My one of my sponsors he had a good friend as a cardiologist, and went and saw him, and sure enough, I was in atrial fibrillation, and don't know how long for, but it could have been going on for a long, long time, you know, going in and out of it, of course, and then that was the, but going ahead, looking back now, I don't know what John would think, but, you know, were these panic attacks that I was having, was I going into AFib during a race? And then, you know, I know a lot of people come out of it, they go in and out throughout their careers, but that was the first sort of signs.
What was your heart rate monitor up to when you were having these panic attacks, Cam?
Most of the time, I didn't wear a heart rate monitor during, you know, a race. You know, it was, but I've sort of got a low heart rate anyway, but it would probably be 150, 160, which is fairly high for me. And then bike and run was absolutely fine. But later on, I think, you know, my performances really did start to come down, and I just wasn't putting in the same performance as what I had throughout my whole career. And just felt like something was just not right. And then I got COVID last year in the middle of June, probably the worst sickness I've ever had in my life. And I think that really gave me a kick up the guts as well. And when I was coming back into training, it was the first time that I had 5-6 weeks off, came back to start training. And every time I started training, I'd have a little bit of a spike in my heart rate for just a few seconds, and then a lull, just felt like a little bit of weakness, and I just thought it was post, you know, coming back from this virus that had hit me for 6, and didn't think anything of it, just thought, it was post-COVID, and something was happening there.
So when you actually realised and stayed in AFib, Cam, what were, like, bearing in mind that the general public might just think that they're having a panic attack, like you've just said, what were the specific feelings, or how were you feeling in that moment?
Well, I mean, before I went to the cardiologist, before I even knew, you know, I still did a 30-hour week training. And, you know, I didn't know. And one of my good friends, Dr. Matt Brick, he doesn't know how I, you know, did a 30-hour week. It was only just in training, just at the start of the training, probably 5 minutes into it, I just had this little spike, and probably some runs I had a little bit of out of breath sort of type feeling, but otherwise didn't really have any major symptoms, major heart rate spikes at all. It was quite even. So I don't know if I'd gotten used to being an aphib for so long. I just don't know.
And then post-training, were you... Oh, you probably didn't have a heart rate monitor on, but I know I've only had brief bouts of it, but post-training, my heart rate just stays really high and it takes a while for it to come back down. That's kind of when I know. But did you just feel like, I know that you just feel kind of washed out and like you have no power at all to get through the session?
Yeah. I mean, I just had that little bit of emptiness and spike at the start, and then it was just sort of, you know, normal. I'd probably say I was probably at 80% of what I really should have been, but you know, I just kept pushing through because I thought, yep, I'm coming back from COVID, and didn't realize, you know, what I was actually what my heart was actually doing, and that I was in aphib.
And John, then ready just quickly, John, the obviously SVT is relatively benign from what my cardiologist told me, apart from the fact it can be super annoying. And but can you talk about the risks of AF, apart from just being out of rhythm? Obviously, there's the blood clot issue. Why is it a lot more? Why is that not an issue with SVT so much? And why is AF so much more dangerous?
Well, with supraventricular tachycardia or SVT, so there are two sorts of rhythms in the heart. There's supraventricular tachycardia, which comes from the top of the heart, from those two reservoirs, and then there's ventricular tachycardia, which comes from the bottom of the heart, from the two pumping chambers. And that's the rhythm that Greg Welsh and Emma Carney are afflicted with, which is a much more serious problem. Okay, that we can talk about that later, but they're... So supraventricular tachycardia means it's coming above the ventricles. That's what supraventricular tachycardia means. And atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, and SVT are all supraventricular tachycardias, okay? Tachycardia means fast heart rate. Bradycardia means slow heart rate. Now, most triathletes have slow heart rates. My heart rate used to sit in the 30s. It's sort of in the low 40s now. And most of us have slow heart rates because of the exercise programs that we embark on. Often, the first time people notice that they've gone into a funny rhythm disturbance is when they look at their numbers from their smartwatches, and suddenly the heart rate is up from 52 to 120 for no obvious reason. And that's when you should get an ECG done, and they'll tell you what it is. Now, the SVT that you had, Tim, is the top chamber's pumping very briskly and the bottom chamber's pumping underneath. So it's going at about 150, 180 beats per minute, and it's emptying of blood. When you go into atrial fibrillation, the top chamber quivers. Sorry, you can't see my hand, but the top chamber quivers or fibrillates, and the bottom chamber pumps underneath, and little blood clots can form inside the heart and then fire out. And that's where the blood clotting risk comes from. So we have this scoring system that tells us how likely you are to have a stroke, and it's what we call the CHADS VAS score. Now, I should imagine Cam has an incredibly low CHADS VAS score. You're probably not on a blood thinner, are you? Or you might be on it short-term.
Probably for another month.
And then you'll be off it. But once you get to the age of 65, as I'm approaching, then it becomes a bit more problematic, because then your risk of a stroke goes up because your CHADS VAS score goes up. So people in atrial fibrillation have a fivefold increased risk of a stroke because of that quivering top chamber, because of the blood that can pool within it and fire out. And we can actually see the blood clots form on cardiac echoes. When we look at the heart, you can actually see the blood sludging when patients are in atrial fibrillation. But as you get older, the risk of a stroke goes up because you start to accumulate problems like, well, first of all, age and blood pressure and diabetes and those other problems that older folk have. And that increases your risk of a stroke quite dramatically. And that's when we put people on blood thinners. But someone like Cam, who's very fit, healthy, and has a chat.
Doesn't drink Coca-Cola or eat meat pies, so.
meat pies don't cause strokes, so thank God.
We see a lot of young athletes now, you know, they're retiring from sport because they're doing such high hit sort of training now. Is that, I know long-term as well, you know, we've got the endurance side of that, but those real intense sessions that they're doing so young as well, is that, you know, problematic for the future as well? Because, I was reading last week a 22-year-old professional cyclist just retired from the sport. You know, her team had said, I think, you know, nah, that's it for you. There was too much of a risk. And, so those high intense sessions, are they extremely, you know, bad for athletes as well?
Well, Cam, I suspect that 22-year-old cyclist might have had a condition called right ventricular dysplasia, which is a condition that can cause very nasty rhythm disturbances. Look, the more we look into it, the more we know that exercise is good for your heart. And you know, endurance athletes live on average, you know, 7 to 10 years longer than people who are sedentary. And they live higher quality life. Even if they trip into atrial fibrillation, the quality of their lives is very good. A lot of the original work was done on cross-country skiers in Norway out of the University of Tromsø. Whereas these incredible, I've been to Tromsø and I've seen these people and they are extraordinary. They're men in their late 80s, early 90s, and they look about 40. And they do this incredible cross-country skiing where they go for days and days on end. And they have this incredible endurance athleticism. They have these massive hearts that just, they're just like the engine rooms of the QE2. And these guys live long and happy lives. A lot of them are in atrial fibrillation. A lot of them on those blood thinners, and they're quite happy to take them. And they still carry on doing all their sporting activities. And I think it's really important to encourage people not to be, you know, scared by these stories that are going around, you know, putting people off saying, oh, you know, I had a rhythm disturbance. I mean, you guys are very relaxed and it's very refreshing to see because a lot of the age groupers aren't. That they become completely and utterly destroyed by these problems that come along, and you know, I think shouldn't dwell on them. Should get on with life. Should carry on exercising, doing what they enjoy.
John, you very mentioned good to hear. That athletes, you know, seeing that spike on their smartwatch or their Garmin should go and get an ECG. I guess should we describe what the symptoms are of the different feelings of SVT and AF? I mean, I can speak from my own experience, but you might be able to correct me having spoken to thousands, tens of thousands of patients about it. I think SVT, you know, it's like a real, for me, it was a real flutter. Like I could feel my heart racing. Whereas I felt like when I was in atrial fibrillation, I felt slightly nauseous, a little bit out of it, but could function fine. My heart rate was sort of, I guess it felt like it was 20 beats higher than it should have been the whole time. Can you add to that and, you know, what people might be, I mean, the ECG would hopefully do the diagnosis for them, but at least what they're,
I think, Tim, it's important to remember that everyone's different and no two patients are the same. And look, I have patients who turn up, they've been in atrial fibrillation for 3 years and they didn't even know it. Now, often these aren't guys like yourselves who are, you know, at the pointy end of sport. They're people who are a bit more sedentary. But it is interesting. I mean, I actually diagnosed Clint's father's atrial fibrillation from some film footage his lovely wife put on the internet on Facebook as Andrew was running past. And he went like this with his – and I said to Christine, who's also an Iron – my wife, who's also an Ironman competitor, I said, he's gone into atrial fibrillation. Like you can just tell, but he was running a marathon and he ran a marathon in atrial fibrillation and did a reasonable time. So some people are asymptomatic. Other people are debilitated by it and find that when they go into atrial fibrillation, they literally are stuck in a chair and can't do things. So there is a great variation in presentations and it's really surprising how different that is. So that's why it's important, I think, every now and then, particularly if you have a heart rate monitor and your rhythm just doesn't seem right for you, just go and get an ECG done. A lot of the time it's just ectopic beats. And again, triathletes, Ironman, you know, endurance athletes, are prone to these ectopic beats, which are these extra beats that jump into your heart. And the reason for that is because our heart rates tend to be quite slow, and this enables those extra beats to jump in, whereas if you speed your heart rate up, it suppresses them and they don't jump in.
How good are the Apple Watches? Because when I went in to have my cardioversion, you know, I don't have an Apple Watch. You know, I've just got a Garmin watch, but I checked on my wife's Apple Watch, and you know, for the atrial fibrillation, and sure enough, I was in it, and then had the cardioversion, came out, and then tested it again, and I was in normal sinus rhythm. And so I've been, you know, checking all the time now, and I just go on a watch as well. You know, are they that good that they can pick it up? You know,
yeah, they're the little cardio device. So there's CARDIA. There's a cardio device you can buy from the Apple Store. It's about $100, and it plugs onto the back of your smartphone. You just put it on the back of your smartphone, and then you put two fingers on the two little devices, and it gives you a printout of whether or not you're in sinus rhythm or atrial fibrillation. They're actually quite good. Wow. These don't tend to be quite so reliable, the Garmins. They're not quite so reliable. They'll give you a heart rate, but they won't give you a reliable interpretation as to whether or not you're in atrial fibrillation. So, you know, if your normal resting heart rate is, you know, 38, 42, whatever, and then suddenly your heart rate's sitting at 110, it's probably worth going to get an ECG done, because then you're not, or using your wife's cardio device on the back of her Apple phone.
I think it's worth noting too, for athletes out there, that the wrist-based heart rate tends to be okay at rest, like fairly accurate at rest and while you're cycling. But once you have the running, the motion of running, it seems to read quite inaccurately. It can come into the right rhythm, but don't be too stressed out if it's 20 beats high on the run, because as coaches, we see that all the time, which is why we always push people towards a chest strap system if they can.
Yeah. Chest straps are much better. Chest straps are a better way of reading than the wrist straps. They're not, or the wrist watches.
The cardio device that you just spoke about, John, obviously my old man's got one of those. And there's been a few times when, specifically when I get a bit fitter and I get a bit concerned. And every time it'll just tell me either 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, it tells me that I'm just getting ectopic beats. And that's when I've come to see you previously, that's what it is, right? The ectopic beats that are concerning, but they are very good devices, the cardio devices, for sure.
Ectopic beats are so common. And this is, I actually discourage, maybe not triathletes at your level, but I discourage a lot of the Olympic distance / club athletes not to get too fixated on their heart rates, because they can be wildly inaccurate, particularly on runs, as you've alluded to, Tim. And then they come in with these reams and reams and reams of paper for me to go through, and every single one of them, you know, is obviously causing a lot of anxiety. And I tend to say, look, switch it off. You're not really at that level where atrial fibrillation should be a problem. It's more the huge volumes that you guys do that does predispose you more to those arrhythmias.
I was always told that athletes, you know, because we've trained so long, so far, that you should detrain and, you know, slowly come down over the years. And is that something that, you know, does help athletes as if they detrain, or, you know, just, or do you just stop straight away?
Look, I think most of us, as we get older, you know, sort of change our goals. And look, particularly, I'm in my 60s now. I trod on the stingray when I was at a training camp for swimming, and that sort of put an end to my activities a bit. And so you sort of tend to move your goals, and you say, okay, that was then, this is now. I'm going to ease up a bit. I'm going to sort of enter retirement with a bit of dignity, but still maintain your fitness. You know, still carry on. You know, I do maybe 10 hours a week, and I'm very happy with that. You know, I do 4 or 5 on the bike. I do a couple of swim sessions and run around the creek a couple of times, and, you know, maintain my fitness that way. And certainly as you ease up with your train, as you say, the dimensions of your heart start to come back to where they should be, you know, with time. I suspect, if you've done a lot of triathlon, as you've done, Cam, in your years, that you're inevitably going to have a large atria and a large left ventricle. That's just the way you are, because you've got a big engine. And that's always going to be advantageous from the point of view of quality of life. But it does mean that, you know, you've got atrial fibrillation and you're on medications for that that fix it. Or you've been okay.
So, John, sorry to knuckle down on this a bit more, because I know the 6 hour a week is not an option for any of our listeners. So, if an athlete was to detrain, let's say if we enforced a two month rest period, would you see enough changes there to, you know, the heart going back to the correct size? Would that be a healthy thing to do for athletes? You know, once a year, should they be doing it twice a year? Is there any evidence for that, for reducing these sort of problems, or is it?
Well, after an Ironman event, it's really important. I know, because I've been part of a study where I came over the finish line in Port Macquarie and had a cardiac echo done by a colleague of mine, and it wasn't good. It did not look good. My left ventricle was completely compressed, and my right ventricle, which is the side of the heart that pumps the blood onto the lungs, was massive from the event. But you find that within 5 days, it was very fatigued. My heart was very fatigued. But within 5 days, it had come back to normal. So yeah. Your hearts do bounce back very quickly. So there's no doubt that that does happen. So, but I think it is important after a big event, you know, which has involved, you know, many, many hours of high heart rate, high cardiac output, it is important to have, you know, 2-3 weeks where, you know, you just potter around, you still keep doing things. Whether full detraining for a couple of months, a year, and then going back into it is going to be beneficial, no one really knows, Tim. This is a new science. You know, this is all new stuff that we don't really know the answer to. Andre LaGersh in Melbourne is looking at it very carefully, and there's also an institute in Texas called the Cooper Institute, run by a fellow called Ben Levine, a very knowledgeable guy, where they're looking at these sorts of issues. But the overwhelming evidence is exercise is good. Endurance athletes have good quality life and live a long time. The subtleties of whether you should detrain for 2 months and then retrain again, we honestly don't know the answer.
After being in sinus rhythm, you know, before when I was in atrial fibrillation, you know, and did some more tests, you know, my ventricles, the doctor said they did look a lot better. So, being in atrial fibrillation, you know, constantly, I know that's terrible, but when you've had your, you know, ablation or cardioversion, you know, does your heart, have you seen evidence over, you know, time that it does improve and does, you know, have those benefits of that ablation? You know, do you see that?
Well, look, we see a lot of patients with what we call a tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy. So this is where the heart muscle stops working properly because the heart's been going so quickly for such a long period of time, often without people realizing it. So these are the patients that end up in hospitals. Often they're not triathletes. Often these are just, you know, ordinary people outside. Their heart's gone very quickly. They're in rapid atrial fibrillation and their heart function deteriorates quite dramatically. When we get them back into sinus rhythm, their hearts come back to normal. They recover almost immediately. But then you've got to maintain them in sinus rhythm, or if they do trip into atrial fibrillation, stop their hearts from racing. Because it's because their hearts have been racing at 150 beats per minute for, say, 3 months without them realizing that they've worn themselves out. It's like sitting with your foot on the accelerator pedal at the traffic lights. Your revs are up, but you're not going anywhere. You're going to wear your engine out. It's exactly
with hearts. And athletes are so in tune with their bodies. I think we all know that if I was sitting here now at 150 beats per minute, I would be, well, something's gone wrong with me big time. So, and I think that's what every athlete should do. They should know how their body feels and reacts. And, you know, you can look at your monitor all the time, but you should also know that, you know, what 150 heart rate feels like, you know, what 100 feels like, what 50 feels like.
I even noticed that I was just sitting at rest at 75 instead of 45. And I remember I went to my wife and she didn't want a bar of it. And then thankfully we had another doctor over at the house at the same time. And she felt my pulse and was like, yeah, you need to go to hospital. You're in AF.
Tell the rest of the story, Tim. You drove yourself to hospital. No
and
one.
And my wife made me drive myself to hospital. But John, I think you're right. Athletes really are. You just know when things aren't quite right, and the panic attacks. Like when I used to go into SVT during the swim, Cam, I used to get the same thing. I'd have a panic attack and you know, I'd sit in there, just head out of the water, just, you know, trying to get my breath back and get
calm. It's a horrible feeling.
So, yeah, it's the worst. And especially when you couldn't, I you can't really explain it at the time. It's only looking back now that I'm like, yeah, I was in and out. And does, assuming stress plays a big part with AF and SVT, like external stress, apart from, you know, obviously the training stress, John, but the just life stress would trigger things, make the incidents more likely?
It's a really tricky area of stress because most of the people who I see with atrial fibrillation, it's either alcohol or sleep apnea. They're morbidly obese and they have this condition called obstructive sleep apnea. They stop breathing when they go to bed at night. It wakes them up. They stretch up their right atriums. They trip into atrial fibrillation. So you're a different group of people. People like yourselves with atrial fibrillation, and electrophysiologists love you guys because you listen to instructions, you do what you're told, and you do really well because of that. Most of the patients we see are not interested. So they're usually 130, 140 kilograms. A lot of them are diabetic. They're hypertensive. They drink a lot of alcohol, you know, 5 or 6 beers a night. And you say to them, look, we're never going to get you out of atrial fibrillation unless you change your lifestyle. Now, Prash Sanders, this friend of mine in Adelaide, who's a world expert, he took 1,000 patients and he divided them up into 2 groups. And the group that he managed to make those changes to their lifestyle, lose weight, exercise regularly, get their sleep apnea treated, stop drinking alcohol, they went into sinus rhythm and they stayed in sinus rhythm. And the group that didn't stayed in atrial fibrillation and didn't do very well at all because of that. So you've got to remember that you guys are different. You fibrillators are different to the fibrillators that I spend most of my life dealing with. You're a different group of people. You're dedicated, you're committed, you'll do the right thing, and you pay the dividends because of that. You're back doing stuff.
So following on from that then, John, is, and you're saying cardiologists love these kind of maniacs, is there any regular testing that would be beneficial for both cardiologists and for the athlete to just know that your heart health is going to be on point every year? Like, is there something annually that these guys should be doing or should have been doing?
Look, I think just routine health checks are important for all of us, you know, so get your blood pressure checked, get your blood sugars checked, you know, once every year or two, you know, your cholesterol checked. If you've got a strong family history of heart disease, those problems. You know, we've all got friends who've had cardiac events, heart attacks. We've had a couple in the Tri Club in Coffs Harbour, haven't we, Clint? And, you know, just because you're a very fit, healthy person doesn't make you invincible. So I think that's important. I think if you're monitoring your heart, and Cam alluded to this, you know, if you're monitoring your heart and you notice that something's not quite right, borrow your wife's Apple phone, get a recording like you did, Clint, and show it to someone who knows what they're talking about. Just be a little bit careful showing it to the guy next to you on the start line because they probably won't know what's going on. But, you know, I think it's important to find a like-minded doctor because some of the doctors panic when they see ectopic beat. Some of them panic when they see SVT. You know, SVT is easy. I can fix SVT with a rub of the neck. It's not a dangerous rhythm. And atrial fibrillation, look, you're safe to drive your car if you're in atrial fibrillation. You're not going to have a heart attack. You're not going to drop down dead. It's just a pest. And I think that's important to realize, you know, that it isn't.
That, yeah.
It's not a lot.
The atrial fibrillation you were talking about with Dad doing the marathon, he actually did. He went into AF, I think it was the day before Ironman, and he said, oh, I think I've got a virus. But he had so many people doing the race. He's like, I'll just start and see how I go. And he did the whole race. Turns out in AF, not advisable, but it does show that, you know, you're not going to keel over right there and then. So,
very important to stress that atrial fibrillation is not a lethal rhythm disturbance. And it's one of those things that, I'm going to be predisposed to it as well because of the training I've done. And I know that I may go into atrial fibrillation. Would I change what I did before? I'd still have done what I did before. I wouldn't not train because I'm worried about getting atrial fibrillation at a later date. It's just part of life.
John, the risk of with COVID or is there much to the inflammation effect of vaccines, of the COVID vaccine, that can affect electrical disturbances in the heart? Obviously, COVID's a bit of a bigger risk factor, but have you seen an increase in, I guess, patients coming in? Sorry, my dog's going bananas. I'll let you answer that while I work out what's going on.
Look, there's no doubt there are two groups of people. There are those groups of people who say, oh, COVID's nothing to worry about and the vaccination's nothing and it's all a big, you know, carry on by the tinfoil hat-wearing brigade and we should just, you know, there's nothing wrong with it and, you know, everyone's too scared about it. And then there's the other group who say, oh, my God, you know, it's the end of the world and everyone who has a COVID vaccination is going to be dead in 2 years. Look, it's a grey zone. And there's no doubt when you have a vaccine, any form of vaccination, you're obviously stirring up your immune system so it can fight an infection at a later date. I used to work in India and I got the rabies vaccination and I was so sick for 5 days. I could barely lift my head off the bed because, you know, your immune system is activated and ready to go in case you get exposed to the rabies virus, which is absolutely lethal. And when I rang up my buddy, a vaccination expert, he said, fantastic, you should rejoice. It means that you are now prepared to go. You know, you've had, your immune system is ready to fight the infection, so you're safe. And look, the COVID vaccination has created a lot of anxiety, understandably. And I suppose for the first time ever, the general public needs to feel that every medical procedure has a risk attached to it. I don't think they'd ever really thought of it before. Now, the risk is tiny. The risk from the COVID vaccination is absolutely tiny. But there is no doubt that there are a small number of people who react, you know, in an unfortunate manner to vaccination. And in fact, one of them is a very good friend of mine. He went straight into atrial fibrillation when he was given the flu vaccine. He went straight into atrial fibrillation with the flu vaccine. And that can happen. But the vast majority of people, nothing happens at all. It's a very safe. Now, there's
so
one group
with our, like with endurance athletes with bigger hearts, does that at all put you in a higher risk category?
Young males between the ages of 15 and 21. So there will be some triathletes in that group. We don't recommend vaccination for COVID in that group of people because they seem to be the only group. Now, these aren't specifically triathletes. These are just young, healthy men. The risk of the vaccination is higher than the risk of the COVID infection itself. So it's a group of people that we don't routinely vaccinate. But other than that, I've got to be honest with you, the whole of Israel was that 6 million people were vaccinated in a 3-month period, and then they were followed very carefully to see if there were any problems, any complications, any areas for concern. I was fortunate enough, or unfortunate enough, the truth be known, to go to a 6-hour meeting where all the data was presented to us. At the end of the day, there was no evidence of any serious adverse problems attached to the COVID vaccination. But there is no doubt that there are a small number of people who, when they do get vaccinated, they get ectopic beats, they may get rhythm disturbances that are concerning. And in those groups of patients, we suggest that they don't get the mRNA vaccination, that they get the other forms of vaccination, not the mRNA. But it's a
problem. Going into sort of that training racing again for people that have AF and then, you know, have been treated, they're back into sinus rhythm. You know, my cardiologist has told me, you know, he doesn't really want me to be in an anaerobic threshold, probably, and probably that risk of racing, you know, that high intensity, and I've finished my career now, so I'm quite happy. You know, I was going to get into age group racing, but I'm quite happy just to, you know, train, go out with the boys, have a laugh, train easy. But that high intensity training for someone like myself, that's going to risk me going into AF again, isn't it?
It is a bit, Cam, yeah. I mean, we would encourage you to carry on, you know, with your exercise program, but maybe to consider adjusting it depending on what your goals are. Yeah. You know, if you really want to be an age group racer, and trust me, it's a jungle out there, then maybe you need a good coach. or you're a good coach yourself and have a program that accommodates a reasonable result without excessive exercise exposure, if you like. You know, maybe a 15-20 hour week rather than a 30-40 hour week.
Yeah. But that high intensity for athletes that have had AF and, you know, for the future, it's you want to avoid that at, you know, cost, really.
Getting it back. And I'm sure the guy has told you that you may need a second procedure doing it at a later date. It isn't unusual. And that's a recognized occurrence with people who've had AF ablation done. Not with SVT ablation, it's much less likely to occur. So SVT ablation, it's about 2% of people need a second procedure. And that's usually where there's another pathway. It's a completely unrelated pathway, not where the problem was before. Whereas atrial fibrillation, you should definitely have 6 weeks off after the procedure because there is still some swelling inside the atria where they've been burning. And then once that swelling settled down, then get back into your exercise program, but maybe change your goals appropriately. Yeah.
So I should have got the SVT ablation about 15 years ago, is what you're saying, while I was still racing competitively.
Not at all, Tim. And I don't think it would have adversely, because you're either in it or you're not in it. There's no house or house. And so, and I knew when mine happened, it was bang, like it happened. And often I was just sitting on the couch watching the TV and, you know, your heart would just go bang, 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 bang. And you'd sit there and think, what the hell's going on? And bang, it'll stop. And it was like, well, that was weird.
I was racing and going into it for sort of 8 to 10 minutes at a time, and would just sort of keep pushing until eventually I'd have to slow down to get it back into rhythm. But
I might have seen you when you were in it. Were you on being followed at Port Macquarie when it happened?
I went out.
The Gold Coast Marathon. Gold Coast Marathon.
I think he was on the.
He was on the coverage.
I was on the screen running. And I had to pull to the side.
Yeah. No, I did see you. I thought it.
looked at his heart rate, pulled to the side, and I was like,
I tried to push through it for a while, and then I was like, this isn't going back in. I'll have to slow down.
And then, it came up. As soon as the race was over, I saw your graph. I went straight in and looked because I thought, and you saw it skyrocket, come back down, and away he went.
Yeah.
You won't have done any damage to your heart, Tim. And look,
I'm not so worried about that. I'm just thinking about all the races where I lost positions when I was out of rhythm.
Oh, look, you're either in it or you're not in it. And it's one of those things, maybe you should have got it done sooner. And then, I don't know, but we didn't know you had it or no one knew you had it. So.
Oh, I knew, but it was infrequent enough that I guess I... It was just one of those things I always put off. And also, I was on the public system wait list for quite a while. with how non-life-threatening it was, so I was never going to, it was going to be a long time while I was on that list. So eventually went private. Yeah.
I know for our elite triathletes for short course, they all have to go and get a SCG before every year. I know it's hard for everyone to do it, but, having an athlete, have an SCG, every year would, be a benefit when you're pushing your body that, that hard. I'm sure professional cycling teams all make their athletes do it, but I think probably triathletes are a little bit, it's more of an individual sport and we don't have that team around us to make us do it, but it would be a benefit for athletes to go and do that, John.
Well, the problem is, Cam, is that triathletes and endurance triathletes like yourselves have the weirdest looking ECGs. You look at it and you go, what the hell is going on there? You've got T-wave inversion, you've got electrical left ventricular hypertrophy, you've got all sorts of weird stuff going on just because of the way your hearts are. So they are very hard to interpret. And one of the best things that comes about these screening programs, and Andre LaGersh is the first to talk about it in Melbourne, is that you see all these weird ECGs and then you suddenly realize that you guys have weird ECGs and that's just the way it is. And so it's very reassuring. If I'm sure if I looked at your ECG or I showed your ECG to a general practitioner, he'd probably fall off his chair saying, what the hell is going on here? Because that's just the way things are. But the ECG, they'll have a record of your colleagues. So each year they'll be able to compare them. And if they're the same, these T-wave changes is what we see all the time, then they'll know that everything's fine. In Italy, they routinely, all athletes, all people performing any forms of sporting activities are screened by a cardiologist. So that happens in Italy. It doesn't happen in Australia. There's no program. Does it happen in New Zealand, Cam?
I know for the professional triathletes and short course program, it does. Not for long course or anything like that, but definitely for the short course pros, it does.
John, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on and giving up your time. Please don't send us an invoice because we can't afford the cardiology fees. But we do really appreciate it. And I hope, you know, that it, in some ways I hope that people listen to this and alleviate some of their fears. And also in some cases I hope it makes people get checked out if they're having anything strange and unusual happening. And, yeah, we just really appreciate it. And Cam, if you've got another 5 or 10 minutes to stay on, we'd love to just talk about the next phase of your life, if that's cool. But John, we're very grateful. So thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
So Cam, what's the plan from here, mate? I was looking forward to following your age group career because I felt it must be a little bit disheartening. I guess, you know, it's, you know, just competing has been your life. Or do you think you will get as much joy just out of staying fit and training? Or will the racing leave a big void in your life? How do you feel about it?
In December when I first, you know, got diagnosed with it, and I was in complete shock, really. You know, my whole world it turned upside down. I had all these goals, you know, going to 70.3 Taupo, you know, Townsville, had the world champs, ITU world champs, and then I was wanting to go back to Hawaii this year. You know, this March was going to be my first Ironman as an age grouper. So, yeah, I had all these goals, and but sort of 6 months on, I'm sort of really at ease with it now, and I never thought I would be like that, because I always thought, how can you train if you don't have any racing? But now I'm just training for the love of it, you know, and that's what I continually want to do, because I have a real passion for the sport and I love it so much that, you know, I'm going out for a, you know, 2-3 hour ride tomorrow, but with my mate, but it's just a, you know, that camaraderie that you have, that that time with your friends, and just, you know, nothing will be hard now. It's just going to be, you know, long endurance and just easy training. You know, as my cardiologist said, you know, he really doesn't want me hitting those anaerobic, you know, thresholds again. So I'm fine with that. As long as I can train and keep myself sane, then that's good.
Yeah,
I see. You're very involved with the juniors now, Cam, and I love to see that, because it's very much what my dad's done. He's gone from, like, always having a specific goal, then finding out that, you know, your heart's probably not what it used to be and you can't actually race as much. So then there's just a real passion to go and help juniors be better at the sport. So I'd love to see that. Love to see that. How's that going for you?
Yeah, no, fantastic. Yeah, they had a great season. They were St. Kennigan College, where I coached. You know, they were national champions. We had the junior champion, intermediate champion, and then we had a couple of thirds, and then a second in the senior boys. So, yeah, had fantastic results there. So it's, just a six-month program that they employ me for. So I've got time off now, and then we'll restart again in October. So, but yeah, really really enjoying that side of it. And, I want to increase my coaching capacity now with other athletes. So if you're looking for a coach, come and see me. Don't want to take anything away from you boys, because I know you do a great job as well. But yeah.
We've got enough. Don't worry.
I just have a love and passion for the sport, and there's still the goals that I want to do now is just more like, you know, go and climb the Tourmalet, go and climb Mont Ventoux in France, and you know, go and climb some mountain trail or something like that. You know, it's, and just enjoy the sport and not worry about the, you know, I'll be probably cheering on from the sidelines rather than racing. So, and I'm fine with that now, because I've been in the sport for 35 years since I was 14, and so, you know, I can you know, be very, very happy with, you know, what I've done.
Yeah, and speaking of what you've done, like like, now that you're a little bit slightly removed, do you look back on it and go, holy shit, like, to win that many Ironmans, podiums in Kona, you know, I think, was there a European title in there as well at some point?
Or, yep, 2006, yeah. European champion as well. So, yeah, it was pretty hard to beat the Germans on their home soil.
Yeah, and do you look back now and go, you know, because when you're in it, and I know when I was in it, I always thought, you know, you're just in it. You think that if you haven't had a good race, the last race, then you haven't done very well in the sport. Or if you haven't, you know, there's always something that you're chasing. And now that I'm out of it, I'm like, oh, it was, you know, I started as just a age group of having fun, ended up as a pro for 10 years. Like, how good's that? You know, so do you look back on it now and just go, wow, like the things you achieved, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You know, there's that racing side, and then there's that racing overseas, going to places where you would never have gone to. You know, like Cebu, where you won, you know, multiple times, and the Pyrenees, the Alps, you know, Manchester for a world championship, you know, Cancun, Tokyo, you know, anywhere in Japan, Asia. I mean, you can race anywhere in the world now. So the sport is. Got a lot bigger since, you know, I first started, but you know, the racing side of it is pretty amazing now, how many races we do have. But I think it's just, I really enjoyed where I went and how we did it back then. You know, those early years of faxing a some race director and just turning up at some race in Spain and hoping the race was still on. You know, now we can be assured that if the race is going to be cancelled 3 weeks beforehand, you're going to know about it. Nowadays, back then, you would have turned up there and, oh, no, sorry, mate, the race is cancelled. You wouldn't even know. And so what we did, and it was quite crazy, really.
Cam, you know, you're known to have a pretty good opinion. Am I muted? No. Like, you do have some interesting opinions on ways the sport could move forward. Someone keeps ringing the doorbell. Give me... But my question is, if you could change one thing going forward with the sport, or there's, especially with long course triathlon, actually anything in the sport, something that you could change with just, you know, you became president of triathlon tomorrow and you could lay down a rule that you knew would have to be stuck by, can you think of something that you would 100% change?
Oh, right now I'd change, it'd be Kona, it'd be men and women competing on the same day as we did for 35 years, and bringing back that, you know, it was always inclusive, you know, the sport. Now it's exclusive. You know, you've got men in Kona this year and women in Nice, and yeah, I think that whole separation thing is just, I don't like it. And you know, it's a sad thing when you know, your partner will be racing in Nice, and you know, there's multiple people that do qualify as partners. And I know a friend who, you know, their daughter qualified and he qualified. But you know, they can't compete on the same day. So I think we've got to bring back that inclusiveness of the sport. And it's been like that for so long. And I think
if that's at the expense of, you know, a little bit of profit, or they have to you know, yeah, not make so much money from the world championships and just have that as that absolute upper echelon, then that's okay. And they should realize that will, Cam, as you'd know, and some of the guys you train with a lot, like it can take years and years and years of just chipping away and getting better to qualify. So that's okay. It keeps people in the sport. So if they can, I very much agree with that, Cam, if they can just have a bit of a, it can be the absolute best in the world age group is at the expense of a little bit of profit, then I'm all for it as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ironman New Zealand this year, we, the roll down for Hawaii, all the men took the spot, and for the women, they couldn't give them away. So that's telling you something. And, you know, the CEO of the new CEO of Ironman was there, and hopefully he took that on and saw it. And, but yeah, when you've got, you know, everyone not even wanting a spot to Nice, then that tells you something. So, you know, yeah, just have the participation a little bit smaller, 2,000, 2,500 athletes like it always was. And the island of Hawaii will be happy, and, you know, most athletes will be happy.
I guess to play devil's advocate with that is because Nice doesn't really have any history, or it has history, but not for the modern triathlete, like the current triathletes. I 100% agree that, you know, that men and women should be racing at the same spot. But I do think it would take time to build up some mystique around Nice or some, you know, to have that. It might never get there, but it's if you had, I've always said I wouldn't mind if every alternate year wasn't in Kona, if it rotated to different places around the world. I think it would be super interesting to give other different athletes who excel at different conditions or different courses, you know, the same as 70.3 Worlds, but I always think coming back to Kona quite regularly, whether it's every second year, I think would be great. But yeah, I think as soon as you separate it, it's it does create a bit of a, it I don't know, for some reason it just seems to cheapen it because Kona still seems to be the number one pick for everyone, right? So
I mean, and I've raced ITU Worlds and Nice, and it's an incredible spot. The beauty about the those Alps, those Maritime Alps, and yeah, it's a fantastic spot. But yeah, as you said, you know, you can go back to Hawaii every second year or third year, but you know, bring everyone together, not don't separate them.
This is just Reedy ruining the fact that he had to go there and just suffer and sweat more than every other human alive every year, and walk away just going, why can't they just move it somewhere else in the world every second year?
No, I mean,
it's a brutal race, absolutely brutal.
It's a brutal race, and I think I sort of hit my Ironman peak when my life was almost hitting its busiest peak too, with three kids, and I don't necessarily blame Kona. I think if I had, I think Kona can be mastered by nearly everyone if you put the time and work in, but there are still certainly some people who are predisposed to doing very well there, you know, the same guys that actually did really well in, some of the guys that did really well in Singapore on the weekend, you know, they also just seem to excel in Kona, and, you know, a lot of it's to do with sweat rates and that sort of thing. So, Cam, you, when you did Kona back in the day, when was it a second and a third that you had?
That, yeah, correct? 2 seconds and two thirds.
2 seconds and two thirds. How different was, like, were you really dialed in on any of the science around hydration and fueling, or was it just trial and error at that point? Or yeah, what sort of?
Oh yeah, I mean, you knew what you had to take. I mean, I always, but there wasn't the science around it. You know, guys know exactly how many carbohydrates they need to take, and you know, it was, I knew I had to have 12 gels on the bike, you know, 4 or 5 on the run, you know, my Coke, water, electrolyte, and that would get me through the race. But I know, you know, now it's definitely, the science has improved the sport, you know, and probably back then, you know, I think I was extreme with what I took on. I was probably doing what people are doing now, but I just didn't know how precise it was in my intake. So, but yeah, it is amazing. Yeah, and the sport has advanced in different ways. You know, everyone thinks, you know, the guys are going a lot quicker now, but the sport, the science around the sport, the bikes, I mean, you know, the bikes have improved so much. When you see Hal Regal, you know, win in 1997, and, you know, he's just got normal spoke wheels on his bike. He's on an alloy bike. You know, the aero setups. I was even watching the Tour de France yesterday with Jan Ulrich, and the position he was in 2003 was just, it was, I don't know how he did it. It was just pathetic compared to what we know now. So that advancements, you know, those athletes back in the day, you know, your Mark Allen, your Dave Scott, your Scott Molinas, they would be just as fast as what the guys are now. So I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I've always said that too. The top guys would be pushing the same power as the guys back then. It's just every year we're just seeing those small aerodynamic advances. And yeah, I think obviously the training is different, but it's not that different. When you go and talk to what the top guys did in your day, or even 5 years earlier, or 8-10 years earlier, it really wasn't. It's not that different.
Like, it's, no, they did the, basics right, and did it often, right?
Yep, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not rocket science, you know, to do a tiny degree it is. I mean, if you don't push yourself, you'll never know how hard to go. And, you know, those 1989 when Dave Scott and Mark Allen went 8:09 in Hawaii was just incredible, you know. Then Crowe, you know, in 2011 went down to 8:03, I think. But even, I think, Luke Van Leer back in 1999, I think they went 804 or something as well. And yeah, it was just incredibly how fast those guys went. You know, no carbon shoes, no advancements like we do have now with the bars, the bikes. You know, everything now has completely got carbon fiber in it. You know, back then, yeah, it was steel, titanium, alloy. And yeah, so it's those advancements are quite amazing.
I thought John might have to fly, but if you're there and have any questions for Cam, I'm just going to add you back in because I thought you might have to take off, but
actually he's probably in terms of the Ironman in Hawaii, a very good example, right? John and his wife were both competitive at Ironmans, and like if they were in that same scenario now, they wouldn't be able to race together at the World Championships. So it's something perfect example of how our splitting them can affect things.
I couldn't agree with Cam more. That I think that's a real tragedy what they've done. And Nice is such a unique race. I've actually done the cycle course for Nice, and it's a really tricky one. What a hill.
Yeah.
It's a very different race.
Mm.
It's a very different race.
I think it is a great race to potentially alternate with because it is so different. It's a very individual race. You know, as much as people... You know, Kona's tough, but it's still very much affected by the 10-meter draft zone, and there's lots of tactics in play. Whereas I think Nice is just a super fair course, and I think over time it could become something really special, but it's going to take some time to get there. John, have you and Cam, what's your opinion? I know, like, part of cycling has always been. It's just a weapons race to get the best equipment and get faster, and that's part of cycling. What are your thoughts on the carbon shoe era? And is there a part of it? Have you might not have even tried some of the super shoes, John? But Cam, is there a part of you that? You can let me know. But John, Cam, have you felt like it's totally changed running to what it was? Like I felt like when I was doing well at Ironman, I could compare to your run times because we were running in a very similar shoe. You know, there wasn't much advancement, but now it's just sort of crazy how, you know, I'm working with athletes and we're finding 15 seconds per K advantage between different shoes for them and things. Like it's sort of changed the game. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I'm glad they've brought in, you know, that 40 mil stack height, because otherwise it starts to get crazy where I'm sure if they didn't, we'd be, you know, seeing stack heights of, you know, 50, 55, mills and just something crazy. So yeah, you've got to have your regulations, I think, in every sport, otherwise it just gets silly and you know, too carried away with everything. So I'm glad they have a few things like that. I mean Ironman's a little bit different. We have some rules for bikes, you know, in UCI sort of level bikes that, you know, don't get taken across to Ironman, like our, you know, the super bikes, the KDX bikes. So, you know, whereas the traditional cyclists, you know, they've got to have a, you know, normal triangle type frame, but we just don't see that in Ironman. So it'd be nice if that crossed over as well. But we sort of take one rule from one sport and may not apply it for the biking, may not apply for the running, swimming, sorry. So I think, it'd be nice if we were compliant in every sort of rule with short course, you know, and bring it into long course as well.
I also like rules that don't make it just a really rich man sport too. You know, you want people to not be able to buy their way to a really good result, you know, over people that might not be able to buy the $20,000 time trial bike. And I think by having those UCI regulations, you end up with, or, you know, maybe not quite as strict, or maybe you do go as strict, or even with the carbon shoe thing, you know, I think having a limitation on how quickly things can be developed and how insane the advantage can be, I think it's important to have that so that people from all socioeconomic levels can get involved in the sport. Or, you know, it is very much becoming, you know, the sport of the elite, you know, so.
Yeah. And I do like that UCI rule where, you know, whatever they have in advancements, it has to be in production, you know, otherwise, you know, it'll just get crazy and things just get out of hand. So, you know, whatever cycling has, it's got to be in production level for anyone can buy it.
And, yeah, exactly. So I remember Sebi Kinley gave me the tyres that only him and Jan could race, and I went and did some rolling resistance testing on it. And at the time, it was like, compared to any other tyre that was available for purchase, it was like 8 to 9 watts advantage over, like, it was in, compared to the tyres I'd tested, all the top tyres, it was crazy. And I was glad he gave me a set. But I was like, this is unbelievable that someone can have that advantage, but no one else is able to get it, you know? And I think that shouldn't happen. You know, it should be, those sort of things have to be readily available for everyone. I think that's a great rule in the UCI.
Yeah.
Sweet. I think we'll wrap it up there. That was a long one. So thanks, John. And thank you so much, Cam, for coming on. The whole aim was to just get people to not be so stubborn if they're having heart issues and think, I'm just having an off day, and actually get it and potentially just look at your data or talk to your coach or speak to a cardiologist if you're concerned about things. So yeah, hopefully some people get some information out of it, and also hope that Reedy doesn't go away and just hear 5 days after an Ironman he can go berserk with training again. So you too, Cam.
Thanks so much. As John said, you know, I mean, either the Apple Watch or the app for the phone, if people can have that, then they can check if they're in sinus rhythm. And yeah, that's one great thing that technology is definitely brought on board. So use that technology to your advantage and for your health wise.